Would turn with me to Luke chapter 14. And if you are new with us today, my name is Chuck. I'm one of the pastors here. And we are just walking faithfully through a book in the Bible called Luke, which is really a biography of Jesus Christ, written by a guy named Luke, who spent a couple years traveling around interviewing eyewitnesses to learn exactly what took place in Jesus' life. And then he's faithfully recounting that to us. And we have come now to Luke chapter 14. And if you were with us last week, you may remember, hopefully, that Jesus was invited to the home of a Pharisee. And going to eat at the home of a Pharisee, or really any home for a banquet, was not like the way we eat. Okay, they didn't have TV dinners, and they didn't sit in front of the TV. And they didn't all stare at something. They were engaged in conversation. This was a way of honoring somebody. This is a way of showing them, we think highly of you. So Jesus went into a banquet like that, following probably a teaching at a synagogue. And unfortunately, Jesus walked into a big setup. There was a man there who had an illness, and the Pharisees said, no healing on the Sabbath. So it was a setup because they brought this guy in. They wanted to see what Jesus would do. And we found out last week that Jesus healed the guy. Well, more takes place at this meal, and we're going to talk about it today, and then, Lord willing, again next Sunday, because this was quite the meal. I mean, there is enough conflict to go around to make your most painful, ridiculous Thanksgiving or Christmas meal with your family that was tension-filled like a cakewalk. All right, this one is just tense, tense, tense. So, Luke 14, apparently you've never had any meals like that. All right? Or you're lying. Okay? Verse 8. When you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, this is Jesus talking, don't sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come to you, and say, give your place to this person. And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest seat. But when you're invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So Jesus is telling a story at the same meal that we talked about last week. It's hard to come up with a modern day example that would help us understand what's going on. When you'd walk into a banquet like this, into somebody's home, at this point in time, the tables were set up in a big U. And you would sort of lean over and sit on the floor and eat leaned over. Some of you would really dig that, huh? Wouldn't that be cool? Then it's just one tiny arm move from falling asleep. So that would take place. There'd be this big U. The host would sit at the head, which was one end of the U. And the two best seats in the house were where? They were right next to the host, to the right or to the left. So if you walked in and you were just kind of mulling around, you were waiting to find out, am I going to be asked to sit at the right or the left? So Jesus walks into this meal, and he's looking around, and what does he notice? He notices people jockeying for those two positions, all right? The one guy comes in, and he grabs his cup, he sticks his name on it, and he sets it down at the right, okay? The other guy sneaks in, he goes over, he grabs the fork, he licks it, he sets it back down. They're all jockeying, elbowing each other. I want those two seats. And Jesus goes into this story. So we have a hard time coming up with a parallel. But let me see if I can give two examples. Okay? First one. You go to a wedding. It's just an amazing, wonderful, beautiful wedding. And then you go to the reception. Walk into the reception hall. And you're the first one in the room. You notice over here are all these tables in circles. Right? Big 12, 15 seat tables. They look nice. Then over here is this one special table. It's a rectangle. It's facing all the other tables. And on it are little cards. You're nosy, and you notice, say what? Bride and groom, okay? And then there's 4, 5, 6 other seats at the table. So you're the first one in the room. You hate waiting for food, okay? You like being thought of as important. So where do you sit? Of course, you sit right at the head table, all right? Now, maybe weddings don't do it for you, okay? You need something more macho. So you're invited by your boss to the Suns game, okay? So first of all, imagine it's worth going to because they're good this year, all right? So your boss has courtside seats, but he also has another pair that he gives out, and this time he's giving them to you. So they're up in the 100 level, all right? Still really good seats. So you go to the game, you're thrilled, you sit down with a buddy, and you look down and you notice, towards the end of the first quarter, your boss isn't there. Where is he at? His courtside seats are wide open. So, it would be cool to sit courtside, wouldn't it? I mean, that's where the rich people sit. That's where the important people sit. That's where you sit if you finally arrived. So what do? You sneak down there and you take the best seats, right? Of course not. You don't take the best seats at the reception, and you don't take the courtside seats, right? Why? You're going to get moved. What else? They're reserved. You don't want to look like an idiot when somebody comes and tells you you weren't invited here. Okay? That's in essence what Jesus says. Right? But here's my question. Surface level stuff is never enough for me. You've probably figured that out by now. There's got to be something else going on here, right? I mean, of all the things, this book really isn't that long. It's pretty short. I mean, of all the things that God could tell us, is common sense etiquette about where to sit really all that important? If any idiot knows, you don't go try and sneak into the courtside seats. And you don't mess with the bride on her wedding day. All right? If anybody knows that, then what's really being said here? What's actually going on? It's got to be more than that. Well, look back up a little bit at verse 7. Now, he told a parable to those who were invited. So invited to this reception, if you will, this meal, when he noticed how they chose to take the places of honor. So, again, Jesus is seeing these people who are supposed to be leaders acting like 2- and 3-year-olds, jockeying for the best seats. Jesus is going to describe today for us two lost virtues, if you will. And that's really what he's getting at in this story. He's teaching us about humility, and he's teaching us about generosity. And really, to be more precise, he's describing how life in the kingdom of God actually works. What does it look like to be a kingdom citizen? What does it look like to be a follower of the king? How do you do that? Well, you don't go in and take the best seats. That's not how you act. You see, a kingdom life is marked by humility. Jesus noticed as he was in this meal several groups of people. He noticed the Pharisees. He noticed probably his disciples if they were with him. And then he noticed Dropsy Dan that we talked about last week, who got tricked into coming probably. And in all of these people, Jesus sees the ones that are supposed to be the leaders jockeying because they want the best seat with the host. And he's just blown away by it. People were thinking first of themselves, not others. They were choosing the best place for themselves with no regard to the will of the host or the joy of those who were there. Social status was really, really, really important in the ancient world. I mean, if you got asked to sit on the right and the left of the host at a big party, that said, you're sitting courtside. So, does that happen today? Anybody in the room like to be thought well of? Anybody in the room like to be, like people to walk by and think, man, they've made it. They're important. That's what's going on here. And that is the absolute opposite of what life in the kingdom is supposed to look like. The most important people in Jesus' day got the best treatment, the best seats, the best food, the best house, the best this, the best that. And unfortunately, to some degree, that had bled into the very fabric of religion itself. These leaders felt as though they had obeyed all the rules, and therefore, they had the best status before God. Which translates into, I deserve the best status before people. Now, the problem with all of this, and I hope this is obvious, is the measure of a Christian isn't how much she's accomplished, but it's how tightly she clings to the cross. Christianity, you see, is deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in humility. And let me describe why. Jesus came to bring a kingdom. We've talked a lot about that. The kingdom of God means what? The rule and the reign of God. It's where Jesus is present and his rule and his reign is actualized. It's being lived out. And in that kingdom, things are really upside down for the way they are in the world. So in a sense, we could call this the upside down kingdom. Where Jesus rules and reigns, things are different. Aren't you glad? The best aren't those who have the most, but those who enjoy the one who gave the most, Jesus. The best aren't those who command the most attention, but those who bow their knee to Jesus, diverting all attention to him. The best aren't those who are served, but those who've humbly learned to serve. The best aren't the most handsome, the most accomplished, those with the best bodies, but those whose countenance shine as people who have been with Jesus. You see, life in the kingdom isn't about bigger, better, faster, newer, nicer, curvier. All of that will rust out, wear out, and turn flabby. Life in the kingdom is not about you. It's not about me. It's not about us getting what we want. Now, there are some groups of people today that seem to get everything that they want. They have an endless supply of money and fame and notoriety, respect. Okay, movie stars. But those are the last people you'd want to pattern your life after, right? Their lives are an absolute wreck. As a whole, not all of them. So, what does that show us? What do you think? What? What's a lie? Okay, so that it's a lie. Getting there won't really give you everything. What else? Getting all you want isn't good for you. Too bad your kids aren't here to hear that. What else? Money doesn't really make you important. The world says it does, right? So here's ultimately what this shows us. God has brought through Jesus this upside down kingdom. But really, it's not upside down. It's right side up. What's upside down is the world and its values and its systems and what it tells us. And it tells us when you get this, do this, accomplish this, have this, then you've really made it. But when we look at the prime example of people like that, and life is a disaster, it's a wreck, then that ought to ask us, something is wrong here. What's the deal? And yet, how many of us lean the ladder of our own lives on that building, and we're still trying to climb up it, not realizing how foolish we are. Because most of us won't ever make it to the top, right? Most of us are not going to become famous millionaires. But you might make it a rung or two up and think you've made it, and then the real tragedy there is you're not forced usually in seeing what a fool you are because you don't make it to the top and fall all the way down. You see, the kingdom, God's kingdom, is actually right side up. It's actually the very, very, very best way to live. A life that's not about you, but about God and about serving others and is marked by humility will bring you far, far, far more joy and happiness than having everything you could possibly want. Life in the kingdom is the best way there is to live. Jesus didn't say, take the best seats and enjoy life on earth while you can. Instead, he said, humble yourself. Take the lowest seat. It's better to give than to receive. You see, Christians ought to be the most humble people on the planet. By God's grace, we understand who we really were. We were objects of God's wrath. Foolish people who were unable to stop turning good things like work and family and food and sex into ultimate things, things that ultimately enslave us instead of giving us joy. And yet God in His mercy chose to rescue us out of that. Not by our deeds or anything we've done, but because of His sovereign mercy. So our attitude, our position, ought to be thrilled that we're even at the table, right? The gospel is the light that eradicates any dark place for pride in our hearts. Because while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And that fact alone ought to make compassion, humility, servanthood flow unceasingly from us towards other people. Because if God loves us like that, then how can we not love others in the same way? You see, and this is getting us down to the heart of the matter. There's a very, very, very direct connection between how you think about God, how you relate to God, how you approach God, and how you do the same with others. If you're overwhelmed with humility that you get to go to God, that you can talk to God, that He loves you, that He cares for you, that He has a plan for you, then humility towards people will just flow naturally. Because you fundamentally don't deserve that from God. And yet He in His graciousness offers it. So if we're humble towards God, then we'll be humble towards people. Humility towards God begets humility towards others. So how do you cultivate humility? There's a massively important question. Many, many of us struggle with pride. Humility isn't the default mode of the human heart. Instead, pride often is. C.J. Mahaney, a pastor and author I really respect, calls pride our greatest enemy and humility our greatest friend. It's easy to see why he would say that, right? Think of the prideful people that you know. Maybe you are one. And how convoluted that kind of life is. And think of humble. I don't mean weak. I don't mean sissy. But humble. Humility is greatness and strength properly placed. It's strength in God. That's what makes you humble. On the front of your bulletin today, somebody pull that out, would you? Could I borrow one? Thanks. On the front of the bulletin today is a list of suggestions on how to weaken pride and cultivate humility. These come from a book that the author, C.J. Mahaney, I spoke about, mentioned. And this is a guy that was a drug addict, was rescued out of that life. God saved him, called him to become a pastor, And now he's planted churches through a ministry in something like 17 to 20 countries. Enormous fruit in his life. I don't know how many churches in the U.S. are patterned after them. They're called Sovereign Grace churches. There's one here in town, in the valley. This is his personal list he uses on how to cultivate humility and to resist pride. Take it, look over it, figure out some of these that would work for you, and pursue it. Because humility doesn't just happen. Pride just happens. Humility has to be cultivated. So work at that. All right, now let's consider another forgotten virtue. And that's generosity. If you would look at chapter 14, verse 12. Luke 14, verse 12. He also said to the man who had invited him. Okay, so he's addressed all the people. He's addressed all the folks there who wanted the best seats. Now he's talking to the host, the person who had invited him. When you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed. That sounds like a party, doesn't it? Who are you having over tonight? Well, I'm having some crips and the lame and a few blind. They're going to be a trip. And you'll be blessed. It's going to be great. Because they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Again, is this common sense etiquette about who to invite into your home? No. There has to be more going on here. Jesus is noticing a room full of people that look like each other. It's easy to be around those that are like us, right? Some of you would be hard to be around a bunch of you who are like you, and you know that. But most of us want to be around people who are like us. It's easy for us to relate to people who are like us. We want to be around people that make us feel comfortable and like us. And actually, the best thing is just folks that are just a little bit better, because then they can invite us a little bit higher than we are. So Jesus is noticing this trend of surrounding yourself with people who can give back to you. So you do something for them, they're going to do something back for you. It's what's expected. But it's much more difficult to give to somebody who can probably have no shot at returning in kind to you. Right? Okay? So you have the opportunity to invite somebody over to your house who is homeless. They have nothing. You can give them a meal and enjoy an evening with them. Or a doctor just moved in next door. He or she is a general practitioner. You get sick all the time. Free samples would rock. Who are you going to be more tempted to invite over? Okay. Jesus is saying, there's a problem if you fill your home with only the doctors. He's saying, there ought to be in a believer, in a follower of Jesus, this heart that's overflowing with generosity, who is overwhelmed by how much God has given to you, that you freely give to others, especially those who can't give back to you in the same way. Now again, let's think about this upside down, right side up kingdom, okay? In the world's view, there'd be no reason to invite the homeless person, right? There is sort of this popular philanthropy today, but really it's filled with narcissism because it's about making yourself feel better about yourself. But in the right side up kingdom, in Jesus' kingdom, why would you invite that guy over? What? He's hungry. Right? He needs a meal. Okay? That's the most obvious reason. Beyond the fact he's hungry, beyond the fact the Bible tells us that God has a uniquely bent heart towards the poor and the destitute. Why else would we do it? Well, let me ask you to just think deeply for a moment. Okay? Not implying you don't do that normally, but think with me another layer down. Who is it that's right with God? Is it those who, metaphorically speaking, are rich and have everything they need? Or is it those who, metaphorically speaking, recognize they have nothing? They're a homeless beggar on the street who hasn't had a shower in months, who people turn their nose up at. Who is it that's right with God? It's those who recognize that they're spiritually filthy, that they have an utter need for God, that they have a nowhere else to go but Jesus kind of moment in their lives in which they become a follower of Jesus. That's who God is merciful towards. So why would you invite a literal homeless person in need over? Because that's who you are. Because as you do that, you're reminded, that's me. I was homeless. I had nothing. I could bring nothing to give back. And yet God, in his wonderful mercy, chose to give to me. And so, as we serve those who may have less than we do, there's a constant, ever-flowing reminder. That's me. That's me. That's me. That's me. Isn't that wonderful? That's part of why God says, don't you dare be prideful. Don't be humble. Don't be a hoarder. Instead, be humble and generously give, because that's who you are. So, if all this sounds really bizarre to you, maybe you've never heard the real gospel. The real gospel is this: Jesus of infinite value, wonderful Jesus, eternal God, left the glories of heaven, came to earth, became a man, lived a morally perfect life, lived years of it in a state in which we would consider him a poor, homeless beggar, and then died a sacrificial death on a cross, rose victoriously, and offers to everyone today who will recognize their need salvation, freedom, being reborn. That's the real gospel. He's the ultimate picture of humility, right? He's the ultimate generous giver. So who's a Christian? It's somebody that believes that story and has put their faith and trust and confidence in God, and who is then seeking to live like he lived. If you've never put your faith in that, today you can. And this kingdom that you live in will get turned the right way around. Others here today have believed the gospel, but honestly, you find yourself far less humble and generous than Jesus. You're more prideful and less generous. What do you do about that? Well, the good news is you're still being saved. You have been saved, and you are being saved, and you will be saved. God is still at the work of changing you. Is anybody besides me happy about that? That's a good thing. God's not done with you. Now, you can open yourself up further to his work by dwelling deeply in the gospel. Nathaniel's going to talk in a few minutes about that. We can actively fight against the sin of pride by admitting to other people, hey, this is a struggle for me. So get with your life group. Get with your Wednesday night group you meet with. Find somebody that you can connect with. Open up to your gospel community. Talk about the fact that you're not particularly fired up about not taking the best seats or about welcoming people into your life that aren't like you. Air that dirty laundry. And ask for help, accountability, support. That's what we're here for. And then every moment as you're going through the day, remind yourself of who you really are. Every time you see somebody that you think is less, has arrived less than you. Next week, Lord willing, we're going to look at the last little bout of conflict in this meal. It's going to be a lot of fun. But between now and then, your heart could be prepared well if you'll humbly look at pride and generosity.